Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
From VOA Learning English, this is As It Is, the program that brings you world issues in American English. I'm Mario Ritter. This week, we tell you about princelings in Vietnam and why some people are dissatisfied with elections in that country. Critics complain that children of Communist Party members in Vietnam have been elected to high-level positions in government. Then, we hear about a very unusual proposal on marriage from a professor in China. He suggests men should share wives. But first, Jonathan Evans tells us about Vietnam's princelings.
The elections have started a fierce debate on social media across the country about princelings. Princelings are the name given to children of high-level government and party officials. Many Vietnamese argue that elections should be free. They say the process should be more transparent or open to public view, and the public should be more involved. The sons of Prime Minister Nguyen Tan Dung were newly elected, Vietnamese media reported. The older son, Nguyen Tan Ne, is one of the youngest provincial party chiefs in Vietnam. He is 39 years old. The younger son, Nguyen Minh Triết, 25, was also selected to be a member of the party committee of Binh Dinh province. Facing such strong criticism, government officials quickly responded. They said that these elections showed guidelines and procedures and were a positive move. Trung Zui Nia is a blogger who spent 2 years in prison from 2013 to 2015 for criticizing the Vietnamese government. He said that a sudden rise of young officials with no experience shows an unhealthy change in the country's politics. It is not clear that these people would not have been elected if they were not the children of high-level officials. The public should be pleased, but instead they are outraged, as it is an unfair process, Mr. Nia added. As a result, he said the public loses trust in the authorities. Pham Chi Dung studies current events in Vietnam. He says that the rise of these so-called princelings shows fighting within the Communist Party. He also said that Vietnam's history shows that if the political situation is healthy, officials feel no need of pushing their children to different positions. The new Vietnamese officials could not be reached for comment. But Nguyen Xuan An did make a statement. He is the newly elected party chief of the central city of Da Nang. He said that he was under a lot of pressure to take the new job. Mr. An is the son of Nguyen Van Chi, a former member of the Politburo of the Communist Party. In addition, one statement claims the prime minister's older son said family tradition and personal effort helped his rise in the party. This development comes as the Vietnamese Communists get ready for their 12th Party Congress in early 2016. That gathering is expected to select the country's next top leaders. I'm Jonathan Evans.
You are listening to As It Is from VOA Learning English. You just heard how some people in Vietnam are unhappy that the children of Communist Party officials were elected to political office. Next, we hear about an unusual proposal. A Chinese economics professor has offered an uncommon solution to help bachelors, men who have not married. He has suggested wife sharing. The idea of wife sharing has caused anger among people who consider the idea insulting to women and simply immoral. Ana Mateo tells us more about the proposal and some of the ideas behind it.
An economics professor in China has suggested that Chinese men share their wives with men who can't find their own. This idea comes from Xie Zuoshi, a professor at the School of Economics and International Trade at Zhejiang University of Finance and Economics. Mr. Xie says China has a population imbalance between men and women. This imbalance, he adds, has left about 30 million adult men without wives. Mr. Xie said if we stick to the moral idea of monogamy, we would be condemning 30 million men to a life of misery without wives and children. His call for wife sharing brought him lots of criticism. Tens of thousands criticized his idea in social media. They say Mr. Xie's proposal is immoral and an insult to women. A teacher in Beijing, Yu Baoyu, says the professor is treating women as if they are a product that a husband can share or rent. This teacher adds, "I am surprised he has the audacity or nerve to say such things in public." Others said online that if Mr. Xie thinks it is such a good idea, he should share his own wife. However, Mr. Xie is a professor of economics and is looking at the numbers. He says his idea is meant mostly for low-income families. Most of the men unable to find wives, he adds, do not make much money. Mr. Xie says those who criticize him are missing his moral point, that 30 million bachelors are in a difficult situation. Many blame China's one-child policy for the imbalance in China's male-to-female ratio. Chinese officials have recently begun the process of changing China's one-child policy. I'm Ana Mateo.
And that's today's As It Is program. Keep listening for the Economics Report, which talks about women and business. Followed by the History program, The Making of a Nation. For more Learning English programs, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Read and listen to our programs to improve your American English. And follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
For VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. Women entrepreneurs are getting more help and resources from governments, universities, and corporations, including money. The number of women-owned businesses in the U.S. increased 44% from 2001 to 2011, says the Center for Women's Business Research. Raising capital is a major problem for startups because they need money to grow. In the U.S., only 2% of women-run startups receive funding from venture capitalists, says a study by the National Foundation for Women Business Owners and Wells Fargo and Company. Yet women in the U.S. own 38% of U.S. businesses, or 9.1 million companies, says the study. Women-owned firms produce $3 trillion annually in the U.S. economy and create 16% of U.S. jobs. More organizations are providing funding for women-owned startups. Springboard Enterprises in Washington, D.C. is one of these. The organization introduces women-owned startups to investors. Springboard began 15 years ago. It has helped about 600 companies that are fast-growing and women-owned raise $7 billion globally. According to their website, the companies created tens of thousands of new jobs and generated billions of dollars in annual profits. Golden Seeds in New York City is another organization that focuses on investing in women-owned businesses. Golden Seeds has more than 285 women angel investors in the U.S. Some companies also give cash to innovative women-owned startups. Cartier is one. In 2006, the French luxury goods firm partnered with McKinsey & Company, a consulting firm, and INSEAD Business School in Paris. They created the Cartier Women's Initiative Awards. They run an annual competition to recognize top female entrepreneurs from around the world. Each winner gets $20,000, and experts from McKinsey and INSEAD coach them. Another factor fueling women's entrepreneurship is the rise of incubators for startup companies. Incubators are often located at universities. They assist startup companies. They provide expert entrepreneurs as mentors and introductions to investors. For example, Babson University in Wellesley, Massachusetts, has created the Babson's Center for Women's Entrepreneurial Leadership. They have a business competition for women entrepreneurs with a grand prize of $250,000. I'm Jill Robbins.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. One day in October of 1859, Americans were shocked by news of an attack led by John Brown. He was an anti-slavery extremist. Many people also considered him a madman. John Brown had declared that he was ready to die fighting slavery. He said that God wanted him to fight slavery by invading Virginia with a military force. And even if the rebellion failed, he predicted that it would lead to a civil war between the North and the South. Should there be a war, he said, the North would break the chains of black slaves. Brown decided to strike at Harper's Ferry, a small town about 100 kilometers from Washington. It was part of Virginia at that time, but is now located in the state of West Virginia. It had a factory that made guns for the army and a supply center of valuable military equipment. Brown wanted the guns and equipment for the slave army he hoped to organize. Harper's Ferry was built on a narrow finger of land where the Shenandoah River flows into the Potomac. There was a bridge across each river. Brown organized his attack from across the Potomac in Maryland. This week in our series, Harry Monroe and Jack Moyles continue the story of John Brown and his raid on Harper's Ferry.
With his force of less than 20 men, John Brown moved through the darkness down to the bridge that crossed the Potomac River. Two men left the group to cut the telegraph lines east and west of Harper's Ferry. At the bridge, Brown's men surprised a railroad guard. They told him he was their prisoner. The guard thought they were joking until he saw their guns. Once across the bridge, Brown and his men moved quickly. They captured a few people in the street and another guard at the front gate of the government armory. They seized the armory, then crossed the street and seized the supply center. Millions of dollars worth of military equipment was kept there.
After leaving a few men to guard the prisoners, Brown and the others went to the gun factory across town. They seized the few people who were there and captured the factory. Without firing a shot, Brown now controlled the three places he wanted in Harper's Ferry. His problem now was to hold what he had captured. Brown knew he had little time. The people of the town would soon learn what had happened. They would call for help, and several groups of militia in the area would come to the aid of Harper's Ferry. Brown planned to use the people he had captured as hostages. The militia would not attack if there was danger of harming the prisoners. He wanted as many prisoners as possible to protect himself. If his plan failed, he could offer them in exchange for his own freedom and that of his men.
Brown had decided to capture as his best hostage Colonel Lewis Washington. The colonel was a descendant of President George Washington. He lived on a big farm near Harper's Ferry. Brown sent some of his men to capture the old colonel and free his slaves. They returned from the Washington farm after midnight. They brought Colonel Washington and 10 slaves. They also captured another farmer and his son. The slaves were given spears and told to guard the prisoners. Then, at the far end of the Potomac River Bridge, the first shots were fired. Brown's son, Watson, and another man fired at a railroad guard who refused to halt. A bullet struck his head, but did not hurt him seriously. The guard raced back across the bridge to the railroad station. He cried out that a group of armed men had seized the bridge.
A few minutes later, a train from the west arrived at Harper's Ferry. The wounded guard warned the trainmen of the danger at the bridge. Two of the trainmen decided to investigate. They walked toward the bridge. Before they could reach it, bullets began whizzing past them. They ran back to the train and moved it farther from the bridge. Then a free Negro man who worked at the railroad station, Hayward Shepherd, walked down to the bridge. Brown's men ordered him to halt. Shepherd tried to run and was shot. He got back to the station, but died several hours later.
Brown finally agreed to let the train pass over the bridge and continue on to Baltimore. The train left at sunrise. By this time, word of Brown's attack had spread to Charlestown, more than 12 kilometers away. Officials called out the militia, ordering the men of Charlestown to get ready to go to the aid of Harper's Ferry. Soon after sunrise, men began arriving at Harper's Ferry from other towns in the area. They took positions above the armory and started shooting at it. The militia from Charlestown arrived at the Maryland end of the Potomac Bridge. They charged across, forcing Brown's men on the bridge to flee to the armory. Only one of Brown's men was hit. He was killed instantly.
Brown saw that he was surrounded. His only hope was to try to negotiate a ceasefire and offer to release his 30 hostages if the militia would let him and his men go free. Brown sent out one of his men and one of the prisoners with a white flag. The excited crowd refused to recognize the white flag. They seized Brown's man and carried him away. Brown moved his men and the most important of his hostages into a small brick building at the armory. Then he sent out two more of his men with a prisoner to try to negotiate a ceasefire. One of them was his son, Watson.
This time, the crowd opened fire. Watson and the other raider were wounded. Their prisoner escaped to safety. Watson was able to crawl back to the armory. One of the youngest of Brown's men, William Lehman, tried to escape. He ran from the armory and jumped into the Potomac, planning to swim across the river. He did not get far. A group of militia saw him and began shooting. Lehman was forced to hide behind a rock in the middle of the river. Two men went out to the rock with guns and shot him. His body lay in the river for 2 days. Later, more people were killed. One was the mayor of Harper's Ferry, Fontaine Beckham.
After the mayor's death, a mob went to the hotel where one of Brown's men had been held since he was seized earlier in the day. They pulled him from the hotel and took him to the bridge over the river. Several members of the mob put guns to his head and fired. They pushed his body off the bridge and into the water. Across town, three of Brown's men were in trouble at the gun factory. The factory was built on an island in the Shenandoah River. The island was now surrounded by militia. 40 of the soldiers attacked the factory from three sides. They pushed the three raiders back to a small building next to the river. The three men fought as long as possible. Then they jumped through a window into the river. They tried to swim to safety. Men with guns were waiting for them. Bullets fell around the three like rain. One man was hit. He died instantly. Another was wounded. He was pulled to land and left to die. The third man escaped death. He was captured and held for trial.
All through the afternoon and evening, Brown's men at the armory continued to exchange shots with the militia. Several more on both sides were killed or wounded. One of those was another of Brown's sons, Oliver. He was shot and seriously wounded. Night fell. Then a militia officer, Captain Sin, walked up to the small building held by Brown. He shouted to the men inside that he wished to talk. Brown opened the door and let him in. For almost an hour, the two men talked. They talked about slavery and the right to rebel against the government.
Brown was furious that the crowd outside had refused to honor his white flag of truce earlier in the day. He told Sin that his men could have killed unarmed men and women, but did not do so. "That is not quite correct," Captain Sin said. "Mayor Beckham had no gun when he was shot." "Then I can only say I am most sad to hear it," said Brown. "Men who take up guns against the government," said Sin, "must expect to be shot down like dogs."
In Washington, President Buchanan and Secretary of War John Floyd did not learn of the rebellion at Harper's Ferry until after 10 o'clock that morning. The president wanted immediate action.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Harry Monroe and Jack Moyles. Transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and archives of our programs can be found, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.